Trib Live is made possible by AT&T, NRG, Christus Health, and BP.
And welcoming the Honorable Michael Williams. Sir, good to
Thanks,
see you.
Jeremy.
Thank you
good
very much. Put you right there.
Thank you.
So, since we have nothing else to talk about, I thought we might talk about fracking for 30 minutes. What do you
Let's
think?
Do that. Okay. Let's do that.
So, you have an announcement, apparently. Let me guess, you're switching parties.
Not exactly.
Not exactly, okay.
But I would like to announce today, and I thank you for the opportunity to do so. I thank you for your friendship, and I thank you for the possibility of doing this in front of friends.
Yeah.
I've had the great honor for 12 years to have served the people of Texas as a member of the Regal Railroad Commission of Texas. But I think time has come for me to take a new venture. And I'm now announcing my candidacy for the United States Senate from the great state of Texas.
Now you of course, I think of you as actually already running. Because in fact, you were running before, in theory, when Senator Hutchison was going to quit, in theory.
Well, Evan, you know, I call that the false start.
That was the false start.
We thought that there was going to be an opportunity to run for the United States Senate seat in a special election. Thought that Senator Hutchison was actually going to resign her seat. And yes, I did throw my name into the hat on December the 18th in 2008. That did not come to pass. We stood the campaign down.
Right.
Went back to working on behalf of the people of Texas, the Railroad Commission of Texas. But now there's a new opportunity.
And this is something you've thought about for a while. So let me ask you the Roger Mudd question. Why should you be the United States Senator from Texas?
Because if I've gone around this state and even this country in the last several months to about maybe a year and a half, people are telling me they want something particular and specific in their leaders. They want someone that is a consistent conservative. They want someone who has the courage to stand up to Washington. And they want someone who can rally Americans around the next generation of conservative solutions and principles and advance the cause of individual liberty. And I think I have a record, a proven record, of doing just that.
Do you think Senator Hutchison was a consistent conservative?
You know, it is not. It's for them to make that determination.
Well, but I'm asking you. You're a voter. Don't tell me as a candidate. Tell me as a voter.
Evan, it's for them to make that determination as to what record Senator Hutchison has, and they will make the determination about what record I have as well. So it's not my place to make that determination.
Well, but sir, you were planning on running for this seat regardless of whether Senator Hutchison ran for office again.
Without a doubt.
Well, should I infer from that you don't believe she was doing a sufficient job?
What you can infer from that, I'll let you do this. What you can infer from that is that where I think the electorate is today, that I think I better suit where they are today than anyone else in this state who's contemplated running for this position.
Well, let's talk about exactly what it means to be a consistent conservative as you describe it. What values or principles do you think make you a consistent conservative and would make you the appropriate candidate in this race?
You know, we as elected officials talk often about cutting the size of government and limiting the reach of government. When I came into the Railroad Commission of Texas, we had 852 FTEs. We have 705 today. We got less than 650 people on payroll. So we cut the size of government by 17%, even though well counts went up about 20%. So there's a record there of having cut the size of government. You know, I go back even earlier in my career, and thank you for mentioning that I was an assistant secretary for the first President Bush. You know, I took a stand that many people thought was courageous. Some people may have thought it was foolish, but it was a position against racial preferences in collegiate education, for admissions and for financial aid. That's another example of being a consistent conservative, fighting for the principles of individual liberty and individual freedom. You know, when we were looking at how do you reduce the number of abandoned wells in Texas that are left to the state of Texas and to the Railroad Commission of Texas by oil and gas operators that had gone out of business, we looked for, and I looked for, how can we have a free market way to do that? And said, we're going to require, you know, oil and gas operators to consider acquiring bonds or financial assurance so that they take that into account when they leave wells unplugged and leave that inventory. Mm-hmm. So those would be three examples I think of it.
What about being on the Railroad Commission specifically prepares you to be a United States Senator? The portfolio of issues that, that you have to address as a Railroad Commissioner or as, even as chairman twice are not narrow. I mean, there's a lot you have to deal with, but it's certainly not everything that someone in the United States Senate might have to deal with. So why should we believe that you're prepared
Evan,
for the
let me beg to differ with you.
Okay.
Because one thing that, we have to deal with in this environment in the national government is how we're going to deal with managing, you know, managing the government itself. I run an agency where we had to make hard decisions about finances. And we made those hard decisions. Mm-hmm. We made the hard decisions to cut the size of it, but still give the public the service that it needed. Right. You had to make the decision as a railroad commissioner about the one of the most important issues in America, and that's American energy security. That's what we do each and every day at the Railroad Commission of Texas, is make sure that Texas, and quite frankly, America, have abundant supplies of affordable, clean, reliable, and safe energy. That's what we do. We can, from the perch of the Railroad Commission, can tell Americans, we have to go after American energy every single place we can find American energy. Mm-hmm. That's the principal role of the commission. So between managing the commission in terms of its finances and dealing with its structure and its governance and dealing with a principal issue, because if we don't have sufficient American energy, this economy can't grow.
And so that would be the thing that you'd put before, and that's what you intend
to
run on. You intend to run on energy as a big issue.
Well, that would be one of them.
Yeah.
But to me, I think the principle, the overarching thing in my mind is liberty. We have to return to a sense that expanding the cause of individual liberty and responsibility for each and every one of us is extremely important for the advance of the country. Energy is going to be part of that. Mm-hmm. When I talk about expanding the cause of individual liberty and individual freedom, you know, another experience as a railroad commissioner is that it allows us to say there are certain places where the federal government ought not play.
For instance?
The EPA.
Right. So
let's talk about let's talk about fracking. Right.
Well, I thought that was a joke. Okay, we'll talk about fracking.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, no.
This is your party.
But the EPA lawsuit that the state has filed, Attorney General Abbott has filed against the federal government. That's an example of an area.
That would be an example. But there's also one at the Railroad Commission itself. Yeah. I mean, quite frankly, the EPA, it's sticking its nose in even the commission's business, not just TCEQ's business, but in our business as it relates to air quality from natural gas producing facilities, as relates to water quality from the disposal of wells, and quite frankly, as it relates to a bill or an interest that the EPA has of regulating onshore production.
Right. You alluded to running the agency. You were chairman, as I said, two different times for a total of almost 6 years. What did your leadership of the agency, what does that leadership time do for you in terms of this candidacy? What do we take away from that?
Well, I think a couple of things. I mean, you know, when I came into the agency and during the course of the time that I was chairman, we had 25,000 unplugged and abandoned wells. We have less than 7,000 today. I think in large part because of a position I took as it related to bonding that I took quite frankly as the sole commissioner in opposite to much of the industry. I think from that chairmanship we also see that we in Texas passed the first integrity management pipeline program in the country, one that was modeled by the federal government. I think you also see from the time that I was chairman that we recognize that one of the things that we have to do here in Texas and across the country to reduce our reliance upon foreign crude is that we have to go about the business of using one resource that we have in abundance, and that's American natural gas. And so I urge the utilization in fleets, particularly among our school districts, for their school buses to convert from diesel and gasoline to propane and natural gas. Mm-hmm. Those would be three sort of highlights. Another one that I'm extremely proud of You know, there's been this discussion in the country about CO2 and how do you manage and mitigate CO2. And some folks would rely upon regulations and taxation and litigation to do that. And many of us think that what we ought to do is encourage the utilization of incentives and technology. And I'm extremely proud of the fact that having been appointed by Governor Perry to be the chairman of the Clean Coal Technology Council, and then leading the state's effort to win FutureGen, and my effort to say that we were going to win FutureGen, but even if we didn't, we were going to do FutureGen Texas style, that we now have investment in this state of people who are building coal gasification facilities to capture CO2, use CO2 as a commodity, not as a waste, so that we can manage CO2, but do it in a way that's productive and economically valuable.
You alluded on one of these points you just made.
You keep giving me these allusions.
Well, you did. to being the lone commissioner on the commission advocating for a position, did you believe yourself to be in sync with your other commissioners most of the time you served?
Most of the time. Yeah. Most of the time. I mean, there were indeed times when we had different positions, but most of the time.
Well, let me ask you about one specifically that's come up. Paul Burker reported on his blog the week that you just announced you were going to resign from the commission that you were at odds with the current fellow commissioners, Jones and Porter, over the question of what the Sunset Advisory Commission has recommended for the Railroad Commission. They are apparently advocating for keeping the commission in the current configuration, right. Have the offices be elected, not appointed, and not shift the way the Sunset folks are suggesting, for fear that if we go to one appointed commissioner, that person would be more apt to be a captive of the oil and gas industry. You would not join with those guys in support of rebuffing the Sunset Commission.
Not only, well, that wasn't the Sunset Commission's.
Well, the Sunset Commission is recommending that the Railroad Commission be condensed to, renamed, but that the three elective offices be made into one appointed.
And that was my recommendation.
Right. Well, I understand that, yeah. but they're not with you on that.
No,
they're trying to get that not to happen.
Yeah, that was
talk
my,
about that. Please.
That was my recommendation, and that has been my position, as many people in the industry know, for about 4 or 5 years now, because I believe that when you have one commissioner, a couple things will occur. You will have centralized direction and leadership. You will have centralized accountability, and commissioners will not be able to sort of duck and dodge and hide, quite frankly. And I think that's best for not only the commission, that's best for Texas. The other thing that comes from it is that when you have a three elected body, that body, in order for you to be able to make a decision, let's say there's a crisis, something occurs, you've got to be able to call an open meeting. But so we don't have the nimbleness to be able to respond quickly to issues as they come up. Because anytime two of us are together, it's a religious experience and a quorum. And so you've got to have an open meeting.
Right.
And so, you know, one gives us that ability to be efficient and effective and to move quickly and to center leadership and accountability.
Aren't open meetings a good thing for the democracy that we enjoy every day?
But there are other ways for the public to get transparency and to know what that leader is doing and to know what that elected official is doing. We don't have problems with the decisions that the comptroller is making. We don't say that, oh my goodness, that's in the dark. We don't say that about the land commissioner. We don't say that about the agriculture commissioner. We don't say that about the agriculture commissioner.
Well, those are all elective offices.
Exactly, and that would be an elected.
Well, but the recommendation is not that the person be elected;
yes,
it's that the person be appointed.
No, Evan.
Yeah.
The recommendation is that it would initially be appointed so that they could be elected.
Appointed en route to being elected.
And
you support that distinction.
I support that. Appointed first.
Right.
Because I would not want the oil and gas commissioner or energy commissioner, whatever they call it, I would not want that person to run in 2012 by him or herself. Mm-hmm. Because I would want that person to be in the cycle with the governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, comptroller.
Right.
And so it is the decision of the Sunset Commission or the Sunset Committee to appoint first and then have that person get elected
in the same cycle
with the others.
Okay. Let's talk about Commissioner Jones and other people who have decided to get in this race. It's a pretty big field. We're talking about a primary now where there are probably five or six or even seven people in the race, it appears, as of now. But the big dog is not in the race. So the person who is assumed
to
be
in the race.
Big,
I just announced.
You're the big dog?
Come on, dog. I just announced. What you talking about? What's you talking about?
You're welcome. Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst is looming over this race.
You mean the tall dog. Okay.
The tall dog.
Okay.
I didn't mean big, I meant is looming over this race because it is assumed that he will have the ability to finance a campaign that will dwarf anybody else's in terms of resources. But yet all these people are getting in the race, despite
what... So what does that tell you?
Well, what does that tell you? I'm going to ask you, what does that tell you? Do you believe that Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst is the front runner in this race?
No.
Would you talk about that? And there are a lot of people who would say, wait a minute, he has the money, he has the name ID, he's been lieutenant governor of the state. Anybody running against him is going to have to topple him. Talk about that.
Let me do two things.
Yeah.
One thing that we saw in the most recent election cycle in 2010 is that message and passion and connectedness with voters can trump money. If money was that significant, we would not have had some of the victories we saw across the country. If money was that significant, Tony Sanchez would be governor of the state of Texas. If money was that significant, no offense, your New York Yankees would have beat my Texas Rangers.
That's true. Yeah, and the Philadelphia Phillies wouldn't have gotten our Cliff Lee. That's exactly right. Is Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst conservative enough to be the United States Senator from Texas? Should you not prevail? Should he prevail? Is he conservative enough in your mind to represent the state?
Voters will make that determination.
I'm asking you to make that determination.
Voters will make the determination.
You're a voter.
Now, let me tell you, and I'm going to vote for me.
Right.
I'm voting for me. Right. So, that's not a secret.
Yeah. I mean, I'll tell you. You've let yourself off the hook.
But I will answer it this way. Voters will make that determination, but voters will also look for something else. They're going to look for, as I said, a consistent conservative. But they're going to look for somebody who can go to Washington and be courageous in Washington, who has the courage to stand up to the establishment. And they're going to look to somebody that they can say, wait a minute, if I got to drive from here to Dallas, I can be in the car with that guy. I like that guy. Mm-hmm. I want to be in the car with that guy. Mm-hmm. And I can drive with him. They're looking for a range of things. They're looking for someone that they trust, someone that they feel is like them, and someone they feel is going to fight for them.
Are you suggesting Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst is not likable?
I am suggesting that I am quite likable.
Yeah, so you're going to stay on the affirmative side of this. You're not going to talk about the Lieutenant Governor. Let me talk about the money question. So okay. The assumption is that he will have sufficient resources. If Congressman McCall gets in the race, has been rumored to be under discussion, he would have the resources. Will you have the resources?
Without a doubt.
And from where?
Without a doubt.
Help me understand your plan to raise enough money to be competitive in a race like this?
You know, in the false start, one of the lessons that we learned is that in the false start, money came from friends and family and the committeds.
Right.
And I think that's where we will start in the early days of this election, the friends and families and the committeds. Beyond that, money is going to come the same place it came from people like, from people who won in the 2010 cycle. It's going to come from people who heard the message and were excited about what they heard. And the message is going to drive dollars. Mm-hmm. And so I feel quite confident that based upon what you're doing today, based upon what other folks will hear, based upon how we're going to go around this state campaigning and around the country campaigning, mm-hmm. that people are going to hear the message, and I just have a sense of confidence that people will respond to it.
So you're not concerned that you may have an uphill climb on fundraising relative to other self-funders?
Well, I won't start with the ability to write a check.
Right.
So in that sense, it will be uphill climb.
Yeah.
And we will have enough money to be competitive, and we will surely have enough money to win.
The assumption has been that Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst is a looming figure, if he's not the big dog, Commissioner, that he's a looming figure in this race. But another assumption is that if the Solicitor General, former Solicitor General Ted Cruz, runs as well, that the two of you would be competing for a segment of the electorate that will be crucial to the outcome of that primary. Would you talk about that?
Well, first of all, I mean, Ted is an attractive candidate. There's no doubt about that. But I do think that many people who think we're competing for the same slice of the electorate are looking at it somewhat superficially.
Okay.
They're looking at a black guy and a brown guy, who both have interesting...
In fact, I think they're looking at two cups of tea.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know that this is a racial issue so much as the what wing of the party all might most naturally appeal to.
Well, but I think part of it is they're looking at that ethnic thing and who can expand the party. And they're also looking, quite frankly, at two interesting life stories, and they're looking at the conversation that both of us have about federalism, both of us have about the proper role of the national government and the necessity to limit it.
Right.
And so there's no doubt that we're going to be competing for part of it.
Substantively, there's not much difference between the two of you.
But record-wise, there is.
And why is that?
Record-wise, there is because I've actually cut the size of government. Mm-hmm. I've actually run an agency. I've actually also been a lawyer who fought for individual liberty. So mm-hmm. there are going to be substantive differences. But these folks will make that determination.
Right. Are there substantive differences on policy that you're aware of between you and the lieutenant governor? Are there things that he's done while he's been in office that you've looked at and thought, if I had been lieutenant governor, I would not have done that?
As much as I like you, it's a little early to be discussing.
Well, I mean, surely this isn't the first time you've thought about how you're going to have to differentiate yourself from the lieutenant governor.
It isn't, but I don't have to do that right now.
So you're not prepared to say any area of policy difference with lieutenant governor?
We're not going to do that today.
Not going to do that today. Okay. Let me ask you about race. You talked about how it was potentially with you and Mr. Cruz, it was the black guy and the brown guy. You are often asked this question, I know, and you're probably sick of talking about it, but let me ask you.
You asked me once before.
I have asked you myself, but others as well have asked you, about the particular challenge of being a black Republican. The House of Representatives now, Texas House, now has 2 black Republicans, 6 Hispanic Republicans. That was not the case previously. Nonetheless, it is always assumed to be, correctly or not, that a black Republican would have an uphill battle in a statewide race. Ron Kirk believed that one of the reasons he had a problem in 02 was at least partly that the state was not yet willing to elect a black United States senator. Can you talk about that?
Let me start with that one, because I had a conversation with the ambassador, Ron, about that. Texans didn't reject a black candidate for the United States Senate. Texans rejected a liberal Democrat. No Democrat won in that cycle. Mm-hmm. White Democrats did win in that cycle.
Right.
So Texans.
And in fact, he didn't do appreciably worse than the white Democrats.
Exactly. So Texans didn't reject a black senatorial candidate. I will tell you that while you're right, I get asked that question quite often, and I am struck at why I continue to get asked that question.
Because I don't think
anyone in this room cares what race I am. Mm-hmm. I think they care about their lives and what I, as a United States Senator, might be able to do to improve their life. Mm-hmm. They could care less. So I would also have to take some disagreement with the way the question was framed. I don't think it's a challenge to be black. Not in 2011.
You don't think it's a challenge to be a black Republican specifically in 2011?
No, not in 2011.
So your intention is to run as a candidate who happens to be black as opposed to a black candidate?
I happen to be black. That's the way it is. But I don't want to cast any aspersion on that because I am proud of the fact that I'm black. God made me black. Who in the heck am I to take challenge with the fact that how God made me?
Right.
I am black, because that's the way he made me. Mm-hmm.
Well, let me go back to the race that you ran for county attorney in 1984 in Midland and ask you about that specifically. As I understand it, in 1984, when you ran for county attorney in Midland, you were a prosecutor in Midland at the time, and the campaign manager in your race for county attorney was one George W. Bush. You made a decision not to run, as I understand it, correct me if this is not true, you made a decision to run campaign posters that deliberately did not feature your likeness out of concern that a black candidate, even running in your hometown of Midland, would have an obstacle to get over. Is that true?
Let's correct it a little bit, but for the most part, you're correct.
Yeah.
We ran a campaign early on where no one saw me. Without a doubt. Nobody saw me. We ran a campaign about my background, but nobody saw the
Nobody saw you in person, nobody saw your image on posters.
And it was a calamity. It was a great mistake.
Right.
We realized it sort of late in the campaign that it was a mistake. We probably would have lost anyway.
Right.
But it was a mistake. And that's why I feel so strongly today about the fact that I am who I am.
Right.
Can't change it.
Yeah, and so there are no places in the state that you think being an African American Republican in this primary would be an obstacle in any way.
Evan, I've had at least 12 years as a railroad commissioner.
Yeah.
The time when I was a general counsel, Republican Party of Texas, platform committee chairman of the convention. I've been all over the state, and I have to tell you that I'm extremely thrilled by the reception I get across this state. Right. I have no qualms whatsoever right. in going to any part of this state and campaigning in this state.
And you're getting quite a reception in Washington. I want to transition to the Washington piece of this. Senator DeMint, who has, you know, he lays hands on people who are running in primaries and essentially elevates them to the status of very credible challengers. Senator DeMint has been with you in the false start, and I gather he's with you in the real start. Is that right? And said, you're the guy.
Yeah. We've had that conversation.
You intend to tap into the national network of folks who supported the Marco Rubios of the world, the people who were the insurgent candidates in Senate races in the last cycle. You intend to tap into that national network as well.
I intend to offer myself to them, and I hope they will accept me.
Right.
But it's up to them to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, one of your cousins in the media asked me, are you the Tea Party candidate? And I said, that's for them to make a determination mm-hmm. of. I mean, we as electeds don't get to declare ourselves right. to be the Tea Party candidate.
But you embrace the Tea Party.
Without a doubt.
The principles of the Tea Party.
Limited government, right. lower taxes,
right.
proper role of government right. for the federal government, without a doubt.
If you're Senator Williams today, would you have joined with many, not all, but many of your fellow Republican senators and sat alongside Democrats of the State of the Union?
In that circumstance.
Because, you know, some people said, even in that circumstance, I'm not comfortable doing that.
In that circumstance.
You would have done it. What'd you think about the president's speech?
I have to admit, I was having dinner with three elected officials that night, and I did not see the president's speech.
You did not watch it?
I did not watch the president's speech.
Well, can you offer me then, outside the president's speech, can you offer me an opinion on his last 2 months of perceived awesomeness and coming back from this campaign? What do you think about
his
how
poll numbers went from 47 to 49 or 48? That's perceived awesomeness. Okay.
But can you talk about, in all seriousness, talk about where the president is and talk about your view of what your role as United States Senator would be in combating what you perceive to be?
First of all, I mean, despite the fact that the president's poll numbers have had some incline, the president still does not understand that we have to do a significant job and cutting spending. President still doesn't understand the necessity we've got to unleash this marketplace and we've got to reform the tax code. President still doesn't understand that we've got to control this border. So, yeah, his poll numbers have increased somewhat.
Right.
I mean, it couldn't stay down there forever.
Well, since you didn't see it, let me tell you that the president called for, among other things, a five-year spending freeze. That doesn't satisfy your concern that the president doesn't understand?
But it's nowhere near the $2.5 trillion right. cut over the next 10 years that was recommended by House Republicans. It's a start, without a doubt.
Right.
But you think about a five-year spending freeze. Think about it. You're asking someone who started an agency and who's been able to cut that and has dramatically cut it over the period of time that I've been there. So I recognize that is a start, mm-hmm. but it's a long, long way to go. Mm-hmm. You know, tell me that you're going to get rid of Amtrak, and tell me that you're going to get rid of NEA.
Are you advocating for getting rid of Amtrak?
I think in the $2.5 trillion cut that the House Republicans, that's right. one of the recommendations. Without a doubt,
so you would advocate, Senator Williams would advocate for getting rid of Amtrak. Senator Williams would advocate for getting rid of the NEA.
Without a doubt.
What else? Tell us now, before we have to vote. what else you would eliminate?
That's why I gave you the start, so
well,
you don't
ahead.
Have
Come on.
To start. I just gave you a start.
That's just two.
We'll give them more.
Are there any other big areas of government that you would like to see eliminated as a way to cutting the
size? We're going to reform a number of areas. I mean, you're going to have to reform Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security. You have to do that.
Right.
But you're going to reform those. But we've got a long campaign to go here, Evan.
You'll fill in the blanks.
We'll come down and
fill in the specifics.
I want you to want me back.
Well, I want you back. Okay. let me ask you about health care reform then, specifically, since you alluded to that. So the House has now passed a repeal of health care reform. It is presumed that the Senate, there may not be the votes for the repeal, and even if the votes are there, that the president will veto it and the override won't be there. The president recommended in the speech that you didn't see that rather than attempting to repeal health care, that we simply identify the areas that can be fixed, and he's extending a hand to Republicans and saying, let's work with fixing the bill. Why is that not the correct course to pursue?
Well, I think, you know, Americans want to make sure that we are as healthy as possible, as long as possible, at the lowest possible cost. And there's some different ways to get there. As you and I discussed in one of our previous conversations on film, you know, I'm one that thinks that what we ought to do is take health savings accounts and sort of blow them up and give people more opportunity to have control over their own health, the health of their lives. So, yeah, it's one thing. So, where do we have some consensus? But if you really want to put people in charge of their own lives. Remember I said the overarching theme is individual liberty? One thing that we can do is provide me with more opportunity through health savings accounts in order to take care of the health needs of myself.
Are you a vote for appeal? Would you be a vote for appeal?
Yeah. Without a doubt.
So, but in the absence of being able to get health care appeal, would you be willing to work on the areas of the existing bill that could be fixed?
Well, I wouldn't want to sort of make that assumption at the beginning. I want to make the assumption that we can make the case to the American people and leaders about reforming health care and getting health care that is consumer and patient oriented, that puts me and you in charge of our health care needs before I make the decision that I can't do that, so therefore I have to settle for something else.
Generally speaking, what do you think about working with Democrats? Are you comfortable with the idea of looking for common ground, or do you feel like that the position of the Republican Party ought to be, we're going to go our own way on this and just...
He wouldn't appreciate it, but Aaron and I were friends before he was a Republican.
Is that right? but Aaron's now a Republican. Let's talk about the Democrats. You know, the one debate happening in the House right now is the House has 101 Republican members, and the Republicans could frankly do anything they want without bringing the Democrats into the conversation numerically. There's an argument about whether they ought to do that. What's your point of view about whether Republicans either in Texas or federally ought to be working with the Democrats?
American people want us to solve problems.
Right.
And in order to solve problems, we have to have the capacity, the ability, the openness to deal and to work with any and everybody. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean, however, that we take our values and our principles and we put them off to the side. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we sit down and we work with any and everybody. We're open to all kinds of ideas. Right. We listen to people who have different views from us, but recognizing that we're built in a certain way and we have a certain viewpoint, we have a certain worldview, and we don't cede that, but we try to find the solution to the problems by working with who's playing in the game.
Right, and that would be Republicans or Democrats. Doesn't make a difference. Okay. All right, well, let's give Commissioner Williams a hand. This portion of the interview is over. And now the hard questions.
That's what I'm saying, right?
Questions for the candidate for United States Senate from the audience, please. We have a microphone. We'll walk around. Question in the front. Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Williams, I'm curious. You talked a lot about exploring for natural gas and reducing our dependence on foreign crude that way. But what about energy conservation?
In terms of how we go about the business to make sure that we provide, as I said, affordable, reliable, clean, and safe energy, then we have a number of things. One is, and if you're talking about power, let me see if I can do it that way. We're going to have natural gas. We're going to have to increase the utilization of nuclear power. We're going to have to move towards clean coal technology. We then complement that with wind and solar, and you get to where you are in my contemplation, you get towards conservation and energy efficiency. Because every kilowatt of energy we don't use is one we don't have to produce, and is one is not going to inure to certain emissions. So all of those are part of the energy plan that I think we have to have as a country. But it starts with the heart and soul. It starts with natural gas, nuclear power, clean coal, complemented by the others.
But specifically to the point of conservation, where's the inflection point on this?
Well, that's as I'm going down, I'm going through a grade,
right.
And I'm starting with natural gas, nuclear power, clean coal, complemented with wind and solar, and also with conservation and energy efficiency. Those have a role to play. But you'll never produce enough energy or save enough energy from conservation and energy efficiency as I can produce with the three big ones, the fossil fuels over here on this side.
Mr. Montgomery.
Y'all let the big issue both at the state level and the federal level is immigration. Do you have any plans for that? And also, as part of that, the state legislature has voter ID legislation on the fast track. Also, how do you feel about that?
Well, I think what the Senate is doing on voter ID and what the House is doing on voter ID is a good thing, is the right thing for Texas. As it relates generally for controlling the borders, I mentioned in our earlier conversation, Pope John Paul II said that we, America, was sort of the continent of hope because we built on this great and grand idea that all men are created equal, and we want people to come to America. And I think every one of us in this room, we want people to come to America. We want the energy and the confluence of sort of the flavors of what happens when people come. We just want them to come in the right way. So for me, the first thing that we have to do as a country, you cannot be a country that's serious in a time of terrorism when you have a southern border as porous as the one that we have. And so we have to control that border. And in my mind, you control that border with a physical fence, a virtual fence, and additional boots on the ground. You also say that employers who are intentionally illegally hiring folks that are not in the country legally, that you prosecute them, and as an old prosecutor, I could find some work for me to do. And you also want people to come to America to be an American. Coming to America is about more than simply coming to get a job. Coming is to be an American. And so there's a number of things that we do, but the first one, it starts with controlling the border. And it's not because we don't want people in the country. It's because we want them to come in the right way. We also don't want the crime to come across the border. And we surely don't want the terrorism coming across the border.
So I heard you say that you're for the fence.
I am for fences in the right, physical fences in the right place. I'm for virtual fences in the right places. And I'm for additional boots on the ground. As it relates to a physical fence, what you really want is physical fence in where you have what the experts call the low melting areas, where, let's say if someone were to come in and they could easily come into the country and escape into an urban area, either get into a house, get into a stolen car, something like that. You wouldn't have a physical fence out in a rural area along the border, because we could then survey that with technology and cameras and things of that nature and folk boots on the ground.
All right. Other questions? Let's do Ms. Richards and then Mr. Graham.
You actually know?
We have returning guests.
With the assumption that your platform is individual freedom and individual liberty, doesn't that assume equal opportunity? And so I would ask the question, how are you going to increase equal opportunity?
I would flip it. Let me take some liberty with the question. I think that a focus on individual liberty and individual opportunity inures to and leads to equal opportunity. The conversation that we might have then is, it an opportunity that is result-based, or are we really talking about that I have the opportunity to excel? I have the opportunity to succeed. But if we go about the business of ensuring that each and every American has the opportunity to succeed, I think we'll get to equal opportunity. That's just sort of my philosophy. But I think the assumption that you're drawing is that we've got to create a result-based system such that everybody is provided the same thing before they can get to equal.
I guess I'm assuming that we do not have equal opportunity in education at the moment. And until we do, you won't see an equal.
Are you talking, ma'am, about Commissioner Williams' opposition to racial quotas in education? I mean, that's a fair point.
Okay.
How does the desire for individual opportunity and liberty square with opposing racial quotas to the question?
The difference that you and I are having is that youngsters today may come from schools that have different levels of teachers, may have different dollars that are invested in them. But the government should never make a decision, in my opinion, about who bears burdens and who enjoys opportunities in the society based upon what somebody's bloodline is. We should never make the determination on youngsters that that youngster can go to the University of Texas, that youngster can go to Texas A&M, because that youngster is of one race and that youngster is one race, but this youngster is of another race and cannot go. What we ought to be doing is trying to put every youngster in the country in the position where they have the capacity, the ability, and the desire to go wherever they want to go and allow them to compete to go do it. So my concern back in 1990, as it is today, about racial preferences, particularly in collegiate education, is that what that does, it tells a youngster that they can't move forward because of what family they came from. And that, to me, is just not the right way to run.
So you don't believe the university, a university, should be in a position of saying, well, we think that having a number of tuba players in the incoming freshman class enriches the experience of the freshman class.
Tuba players is one thing.
But we also think that having an ethnically or racially or religiously diverse class would also enrich the experience of the freshman.
I think tuba players, it's important to have a lot of tuba players. It's also important to have a diverse, ethnic diversity.
Yeah.
But there's ways to get ethnic diversity.
Okay, so in the absence of quizzes wrap this, in the absence of quotas, then tell what is your solution for the problem of not achieving sufficient racial diversity in an organic way?
Well, you know, universities could do a number of things. They could go out and look for kids that have that first in the family to go to college, and they could reach out.
That's not a bloodline issue, I guess.
Well, no, but it's not racial. I mean, race is very, very different. Yeah. We don't have in our Constitution, we don't have a prescription along those lines. Mm-hmm. We have a prescription in the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment on purpose that relates to race, because it's been so painful in the history of our country. So we need to be real careful about making distinctions between people based upon race.
Mr. Graham.
This is my question. My question, you have no challenge raising money. My question is, how much money do you need to raise to win?
Your finance chairman has a question.
He didn't do that.
Yeah.
You know, Thomas, I think we have said somewhere between $7 and $8 million for a primary race, and then we'll go on from there.
It's an awful lot of money to win a primary race, isn't it?
I think that's somewhere along the lines where Senator Cornyn was. And
is there too much money in politics?
Well, you know, money is a reflection of support. Money is a reflection of their passion. And so, you know, I think the more money that's in politics is a reflection of how passionate donors are and how energetic they are.
So you think 7 to 8 will be enough?
Oh, yeah, in Texas, that should be enough.
Okay.
And that's even if someone else spends 17 or 20 of their own.
Somebody you're not going to name or speak of specifically. Although I wish to hell you would.
I want to come back.
Question in the front.
Commissioner, if you were to be elected, you'd be expected to make a lot of decisions about foreign policy in the Senate. And I'm wondering if you have any sort of an overarching foreign policy vision.
Yeah, we didn't talk about foreign policy, but obviously if you were senator, that's true. That would be part of your responsibility.
I would give me a specific question, if you could.
Would you put a label on yourself such as neoconservative, realist, liberal interventionist? Probably not that, but there are all sorts of formal foreign policy labels out there. I mean, it's too detailed to ask you what you think of Israel or Russia or China, but is there a vision that you would approach, that you would take to foreign policy questions?
I'll ask you about Israel, Russia, and China. I mean, the reality is you want to be in the Senate. In theory, you ought to know something about the things you're going to confront.
Yeah, but Israel is a strategic and long-term friend of the United States, should continue to be such a friend. China is a growing and significant player on the global landscape. And I think one of the things that we have to, in my sense, having just returned from China about 2 months ago, we might want to recognize, China right now, I think, has some assets. Number one, it has 1.3 billion people. Number two, it has a lot of money, most of it ours, a lot of it's ours. And third, It has a sense of national purpose. And by that, I mean this. If you talk to a guy that we saw that was with a whisk broom sweeping a dirt street, to the deputy mayor of Pudong province, they all want the same thing. They want for that country to prove to the rest of the world that they're important and they're significant. And that's a pretty good thing. It would be my hope that each and every one of us and every person outside of this room would have a shared vision about the future of America, just as they do. Now, having said something, those three positive things about China, it's also important for me to say that I think China has some limits. And the limits is that they don't have our entrepreneurial spirit. They don't have our sense of creativity. They don't have our sense of innovation. The Chinese can build new airports in advance of the Olympic Games, and they can build a fabulous rapid train where we went 200 miles an hour and we were sitting still and it's feeling as if we were sitting right here. But that's because they can throw a bunch of people at building that train. But we are going to create, and what we have to do is turn loose this economy and this engine here so the innovators in America can go about the business of creating new products, new services, new things.
Other questions for the commissioner?
Way in the back.
All the way in the back. High speed, right?
What are your thoughts on that as to whether it's a good idea?
Right. I know it's quaint to ask the railroad commissioner about the railroad, but indulge us.
But indulge us. If the marketplace is prepared for that kind of demand, I think that would make sense. But the marketplace is not prepared for it.
Why is that?
No, I said if the marketplace is not prepared for it, and we'll have to wait and see. But if the marketplace is prepared for it, but if you go out and build it just simply because you think it's a neat idea, you'll end up with the same kind of thing that I think is going to happen with China. If you go to China now, you go to Beijing and Shanghai and Tianjin and all of those big cities in China today, you will see huge buildings, many of whom are almost empty. Because when you have a government-controlled economy, you get two things in particular. You get waste, you get corruption. And so if the marketplace, if the people in this room and outside say that that's the way they want to move, to get to work, to go to the game, to go see their family and friends, then that would be a good idea. But if it's simply because the government says we ought to do it because it's a neat thing to do, or it's the vogue thing to do, I'd be opposed to it.
Question, Amanda, in the back right there. Hand up. Why don't you start by shouting, and then we'll get the microphone to you.
I can shout.
Dr. Henson.
Commissioner Williams, you were at UT just almost 4 years ago. We're really happy to have you. Somebody asked you about a question about human-caused climate change. And you basically said, and if I remember your phrase correctly, you said the jury was out. Has the jury come back in, and if they're still out, how are the deliberations going?
You know, I was probably being kind when I said the jury is out. I obviously am one that has not accepted the notion that we humans are adversely impacting the climate by the utilization of energy and thereby the production of CO2. So that's where I am. But
put you down as you don't believe in climate change.
You can put it down and you can underline it.
Yeah.
So, you know, but and having said that, and I said earlier, I'm particularly proud of the work that we've done in this state, where I believe we're poised in this state to not only lead the country, but also to lead the world in common sense, market-based ways to manage CO2. We did that with three different sessions, legislative sessions. The last one, which says that if you take and if you have a power plant and you're generating CO2, of course, because you're going to be using either coal or natural gas, but you're using coal, and you capture that CO2 and you put that CO2 in a pipe and you take that pipe out to an oil field, and you use that CO2 for enhanced oil recovery, and thereby generate more crude for this state and this country, that this state is now going to provide you with tax relief for having done so. I think that's a smart thing. I think we ought to, it would be helpful in this state as well as around the country that we found other ways to utilize CO2 as a commodity, whether it is joining CO2 with algae as well as cancer cells, believe it or not, so that we could make a liquid diesel fuel or liquid-like diesel fuel or other kinds of things that we could do with CO2. So we don't have to be afraid of CO2, because I think some of us believe that CO2 is a commodity.
Let me take one or two more.
They're tired.
They are, but we're not. Okay, let's make Mr. Richards the last one here. Yes, sir.
A theme that has cropped up several times during your talk today, for which thank you very much, is the federal government as a threat to individual liberty. Do you see other threats to individual liberty, and do you see any in which the federal government might actually be on the citizen's side?
Well, you know, we've discussed threats such as in energy and health care. It can obviously be on the public side in terms of national defense. It could and ought to be on our side in terms of the control of the border. There is a role for it to, the federal government to play, obviously, in terms of spurring entrepreneurship and innovation. But that latter one, obviously, the bulk of that is going to come from you. But the federal government and the national government can create an environment where you can succeed and where you can prosper and where you can create.
When did it happen that the federal government became our enemy? Where was the point at which that shifted?
You know, I would go back to the framers. Remember, the framers said in the 10th Amendment.
This is when the founding fathers eliminated slavery, as I heard this week.
The framers said that, you know, those powers.
So not expressly confirmed. It was back in that day.
You know, the framers were frustrated, were anxious, were concerned about an all powerful government. They recognized that. Obviously, that when the expanse of the government expanded, right,
my question though is: at what point did we go from the good conception of the federal government to the bad conception? Where was that?
Point? The framers said that there is a proper role. There's a proper role for the government to play, and beyond that role, is not a good thing. So this has always been sort of a love-hate.
Ongoing tension.
Always. Mm-hmm. And always been. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, let's leave it there. We want to thank Commissioner Williams for his time. We appreciate it. Thank you all. We'll see you next week. We appreciate it.
Pleasure.
All right,
pleasure.
Trib Live is made possible by AT&T, NRG, Christus Health, and BP.